Hi, and thanks for being here, especially with all the competing sessions, which we got really lucky with today. what I'm talking about is how antibiotic resistance moves through agroecosystems. So the resistance genes and the antibiotics themselves enter agroecosystems through animal manures. And so I'm a manure girl, and so I'm always a proponent of understanding that manure is the way a lot of these things get into the environment. And then we have the concern that maybe the environment may serve as a sort of conduit for moving between ecosystems. So in the waters, the airs, human, and environmental. And so there have been, as Dr. Tiji pointed out, there have been a lot of panels this year, national and international. This is a huge, huge focus issue. And every single report that I've seen from CDC, WHO, you name it, has said that there needs to be more science-based information to bridge gaps in understanding how resistance travels through agroecosystems. So this is an important aspect and a focus area every time you see a report come out. And then, of course, we are very interested in identifying and characterizing mitigation strategies so that we can still have food security as well as human security. So one of the interesting things, and I think it's kind of come out in the other talks, is that antibiotic-resistant bacteria can take a lot of different forms in the environment. Resistance is a natural part of microbial populations. It's ancient, as Lisa just showed. It's very prevalent even in prairie soils that haven't seen any resistance antibiotic input. But then you can have subsets of selected or enriched soil flora that are kind of impacted by human activity. And hopefully I'll show a little bit that it's manure application, but it may be also just fertilization. Enriched populations are that subset that are enriched by the addition of nutrients to the soils, and selected are the bacteria that are selected due to pharmaceuticals, and that's more of a long-term, evolutionary kind of selection process where they're exposed to residuals. And then you also have the adapted gastrointestinal flora that makes it into the agroecosystem and stays there for a period of time. They could become a part of the microbial population in the soil, or they could just be passing through. And that's where you get your questions about Clostridia bacteroides, who's most important in terms of their association from the gut flora. Or they can be all of the above. And actually, as with micro, the answer is always all of the above. And so they're probably a mixture of all of these populations, and understanding which populations are most important and most relevant to the concerns that we have is key. So why do we care about resistance that's not in a human pathogen or in the clinic or even on meat that goes through a processing facility? And as you're all aware, soils are extraordinarily diverse. So I was on it's the International Year of Soils, and I was on the Soils Are Living group, and Mary Stromberger came up with the soils are living, diverse, and complex. And there's incredible diversity in soil. More importantly, bacteria in the soils interact with each other in many, many different ways. If you were to take, say, this one bacterium and look at that, the way that they can transfer genes or acquire genes, they can take up free DNA. So if you imagine that the red is a resistance gene, they can take up this free DNA into their cells. There can be viral transmission from one bacterium to another. Or you can have a conjugation, so you can have plasmids. So say this is a plasmid, and it can move from one bacterium to another. So there's just a lot of ways that bacteria are talking to each other in the soil. So as Dr. Tiji said, you care about the pathogens, of course, but we also care about what's going on with the normal soil populations. So some of the aspects in addressing these gaps that everybody's been talking about is, do the antibiotic-resistant populations respond in the soil after manure application? is there some kind of relationship between manure application and genetic elements that are normally associated with antibiotic resistance? And very importantly, can antibiotic resistance genes move in these kind of competitive agricultural environment, competitive environments that we see in ag? So the first study is one that I did with Western Kentucky University. This is Nestle Nethensinghe, who is at Western and been great help to me in these studies. We looked at poultry litter application. It was applied twice in conventional or no-till method. And we took soil cores on many, many different days. And then for the purposes of the talk, we measured antibiotic resistance, and this is just a qPCR analysis of sulfonamide resistance and streptomycin resistance. So this is a SOL1 gene, and this is days after litter application, and copies of the gene. In the red is the conventional till year one, conventional till year two. And what you see is that concentrations go, this is background, so as Lisa pointed out, especially for sulfonamides, there's a lot of background sulfonamide resistance, and we saw that in our soils before there was any treatment. There was a good concentration. But then within days of application, you see 3, 4 or more orders of magnitude increase in soils that had the poultry litter applied in both years. And those stayed for a period of time, a couple of weeks, and then started to decrease. And so we were back to kind of the background levels in the second year. And so the question is, who are these bugs? And so I would say maybe these are manure-associated bacteria. They respond, they increase quickly after manure is applied, and then they kind of decrease back down. Here's streptomycin resistance, same thing for conventional till and no-till. And we actually saw in this case that it was 10 or 15 days before we saw a spike, the highest spike in the population. So I would argue that this delayed peak is these some kind of maybe soil-associated populations responding to the nutrients that we're applying with the manure. So maybe these are enriched microbial populations from the soil. And just to show you, this is a no-till, so in the same year, so conventional till and no-till in the same year responded exactly the same way. So there was really no tillage effect. And then this is the second year, and this was only a two-year study, and so, you know, there could be so many environmental factors, obviously. But what we found is that in reapplication, the peaks were lower, they occurred earlier, and there were fewer days above background. So there's been some conflicting evidence. Some people do see there's an accumulation over time, but there's really not a study that I've seen that there's like a steady accumulation in the concentration of resistance. So yes, the populations do respond to manure application, and maybe those are both manure bugs that are coming in with the manure and also the microbial population that's in the soils responding to nutrients in application. There's really no management effect that I saw, and reapplication didn't result in like a steady increase in background in the amount of resistance and accumulation. So next, is there a relationship between manure application and genetic elements that are commonly associated with antibiotic resistance? And Jim talked about this class 1 integron, and it's a very popular topic with microbiologists right now because it's got a unique capability in that it can take up genes, it can express those genes, and it can move those genes within different locations. Now, it's not mobile itself, but they commonly take up genes for antibiotic resistance, and they're also commonly associated with plasmids or transposons that move from one cell to another or one location to another. So there's been a lot of evidence, and I think Jim showed that really well, that there's a lot of association between the development of these class 1 integrons and the transmission of antibiotic resistance or the increase in antibiotic resistance showing up in environmental systems but also in clinical systems. So these These integrons are present in environmental bacteria, humans, animals, just very widespread. And they've even been considered as, and Mike Gillings, I guess, has proposed them as a proxy for like a source tracking tool, not a source tracking, but an indicator tool for contamination. So we wanted to know in our soils with different types of air, either control. So by control, I don't mean never impacted. I mean soils that are not with no manure applied. And then the red is the soils with manure applied. These are actually copy numbers. So you can see the beef, this is a feedlot sample. There was some background in the control, but we were below detection limit in both the poultry and the swine. Soils with the applied manures, and then really high concentrations of this class one integron in the soils with the applied manures. And then this is normalized, so this is the way a lot of people show the data, which they should in this case, for example, because there's really high concentrations in the beef feedlot soil. So this is kind of normalizing the data, and you can just see that there's a high portion of the population that have this class one integron. And then we looked at, this is the same poultry litter study, and this is the conventional till samples over different days. And you can see, it's not on here because the before application, the concentrations of this class one integron were below detection limits. So you go day zero below detection limits, day two you're at 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th. And then you have a decline over time. So this is kind of similar, 3-4 more orders of magnitude in this case. And then, and so the question is, maybe these are, again, manure associated. Maybe this is coming in with the manure application. And so we did, similar to what Jim was talking about, we looked at the correlation, and there is a strong known correlation of sulfonamides and class one integrons. And we did see a very good correlation between the two. And with tetracycline, which I didn't show my data on that, but it was similar to sulfonamides where it increased very rapidly after manure application. Again, a very strong correlation. And then when we looked at streptomycin, where I was saying, you know, maybe those are bugs that are responding to manure application as opposed to the integrons and the sulfonamides, which seem to be increasing immediately after application, there was no correlation. So there are significant increases in these genetic elements that may be stockpiling resistance, and there's a strong positive correlation between some kinds of resistances that we see in the soils with applied manures and these class one integrons. And so, as Jim said, there may be some association between the linkage of some kinds of antibiotic resistance with these integrons. Okay, so finally I want to talk about mobilization of these genes. So, you know, we really, really care a lot less if these are in pseudomonads that are sitting in the soil. We haven't cared for millions of years until we started using antibiotics. And so really the question is can these genes get from somewhere where they're not really worrisome or causing problems to not just clinical settings, but can they start moving these along the ecosystem pathway to get to a place where they're a problem? And so I did this work actually in Connie Smalley's lab in Braunschweig in Germany. They were awesome, and they've got a lot of expertise in capturing plasmids and in antibiotic resistance. So I'll kind of walk you through this methodology a little bit. This is, say you imagine this is your microbial pool in an environmental sample, and say these are all different genes for antibiotic resistance. So extremely diverse, a lot of different populations. And then you have a kind of lab strain. So this is your donors, plasmid donors. These are your recipients. So they don't have, they have known resistances. They have a green fluorescent protein gene so that you can see them. So anyway, they've got a lot of selection mechanism about them. And they're also known to be a good recipient, so they're willing to take up these plasmids. And so you mix your environmental sample, and you mix your recipient, and you then select to see which one of the plasmids from this environmental sample can be taken up into your lab strain. And so we selected them on gentamicin, streptomycin, and tetracycline, just some common resistance genes. So we had 153 transconjugants, so that's basically, you know, of these putida that took up the plasmids. And in fresh poultry litter, we found that they were mainly, and I should add two things. One is this is very preliminary, and two, I'm going to talk about it a little bit like it's quantitative when really we would have to repeat this. But we did find a lot of gentamicin resistance, and I should say I was working with someone who was doing biosolids at the same time. And so we did all of this together. She was walking me through it, and she didn't see any gentamicin resistance. So this was kind of a special thing for our litter, for one. And then we also saw, got transconjugants with streptomycin resistance, and then we had applied poultry litter, which you would just assume would show some subset of the gentamicin and streptomycin resistance, and because it's microbiology, that was absolutely not the case. Instead, we had tetracycline resistance, so who knew? We then looked at, this is UAN fertilized, so conventional fertilized soil, and we also saw gentamicin resistance. So I was really bothersome to a lot of my people about whether they mislabeled the samples. Because you think when you're going to the soil, you know, maybe that these guys were more associated with the poultry litter, but that wasn't the case. So then we did some characterization, and I'll kind of briefly go through these. These are the fresh poultry litter and the conventional till. I mean, sorry, the conventional fertilizer, looking at gentamicin resistance. So they were resistant to gentamicin, but also at double the concentration that we had originally isolated them on. And streptomycin is in the same class of antibiotics, so many of them were also streptomycin resistant. And kind of vice versa, the streptomycin from the fresh poultry litter, those transconjugants, many of them were resistant to gentamicin, but the tetracycline isolates were not. And then for tetracycline, obviously resistant to tetracycline, but not so much from the other transconjugants. And then we wanted to see, because as I said, we had seen a lot of the class 1 integron in the soils with applied manures. So we thought maybe these should be pretty closely associated with the fresh poultry litter. They should have a lot of this class 1 integron in these plasmids that we captured. So it's not, okay, they're in the soils or they're in the litters, and then they're moving those elements over to these recipients. And we found really, especially for these gentamicin resistance, it was very little class 1 integron. About half of our streptomycin-resistant transconjugants had it, and low on tetracycline. So I was actually surprised, and this may be a methodology, like as Lisa says, you have to be careful about how you're interpreting this, so maybe it's just part of the methodology and obviously needs to be repeated. But we also looked, and I should say I just put these up because we had some results from these, but we looked at a lot of different classes of plasmids, the classes of integrons, and really we were stunned. We kept going through and like negative and negative and negative. And this goes back to something we had discussed earlier in a manure micro talks that we had this morning, that basically, you know, once you start getting into these manure populations, you end up with something that's completely different a lot of times than what you're usually seeing. And, I mean, I still need to do a lot of work here, but this seems to be the case. So these INCP are a class of plasmids that are broad host range. So that means they can move between a lot of different kinds of bacteria, gram-negatives, gram-positives, closely associated with, commonly associated with antibiotic resistance. And so these poultry litter gentamicin resistant transconjugants mostly had INP, and a little bit less for some of these others, but also interestingly, it's in the applied poultry litter as well. So maybe some association there. And then, of course, because that I'm, you know, an ag girl, an ag lab girl, but we also wanted to see, is there some kind of association with what's going on inside of the, with the nutrients? Like, I really feel like there must be, you know, maybe there's some link with the kinds of soils that you have or the nutrient availability. And so this is when I started to believe the UAN data a little bit, because what we found is, you know, in poultry litter, of course, is really high and readily available nitrogen. And when we looked at the conventional fertilizer, really high in highly available nitrogen, as you would assume. But maybe there's some kind of association. Maybe that's some kind of population responding to this readily available nitrogen. And as Dr. Tichy pointed out, antibiotic resistance is often co-selected with metal resistance. And so in our applied poultry litter samples where we had high tetracycline, we also found higher metals. And this is really, really preliminary and just going out on a limb. But, you know, and the need to try to correlate what's going on in your populations is basically what I'm getting at. So these genes are mobilized, and they're mobilized in these really competitive environments. And so I wanted to kind of make some suppositions here that maybe, you know, when you're looking at mobilization associated with the fresh poultry litter, you're looking at obviously an adapted population that came from the manure. They're making it in the litter. They had the gentamicin and streptomycin. In the applied poultry litter, you could either be looking at a population that's already present in the soil and it's responding to the nutrients, or it could be a subset that I couldn't pick up of the litter population that is present in the soil. And then for the UAN, I would assume that there are some bacteria that are enriched in that population. So just looking at not only what's there, what's mobilized, but who are these guys? Getting back to who do we need to worry about? And so, you know, just in terms of future directions, I really need to quantify how mobilized these plasmids are, because it's very important, and look at more resistances, because it's like anything with culture, you're pre-selecting your isolates, better characterizing these guys. And, you know, I preached it hopefully enough, the figuring out which portion of the population we need to care about. And then definitely, and Dr. Tichy talked about risk analysis and really understanding what does this mean. You know, you can characterize it to death, but what does it really mean for health risks? And I just wanted to thank a bunch of people that have worked with me. This is Connie Smala's lab and Nestle, and this is Rohan, who does all the work. And thank you. Thank you.
Has there been any studies on antibiotic-resistant fungi, and would it be possible for these plasmids to be transferred to fungi?
I would defer to someone who knows a lot more than me, Jim. But I wouldn't think they would move between fungi and the bacteria. But there is resistance in fungi, but much less is being done because, as always, with things that are harder to work with. Tom, maybe, too. Maybe some, right. No, it's an interesting question, and I really haven't seen people working on that.